This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss the criminal charges against Julian Assange and now Glenn Greenwald and what they mean for the future of a free press.
Trump's fascist pal in Brazil has done the same thing to Glenn Greenwald that Trump has done to Julian Assange. Give a listen.
We delve into the Democrats' failed efforts to remove Trump from office.
Impeaching Trump on the narrowest of charges has shown to be a waste of time, and in fact, it may even backfire.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
A recent Washington Post op-ed by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden connected Brazilian prosecutors' recent decision to file charges against American investigative journalist Glenn Greenwald with the U.S. government's efforts to prosecute WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Snowden wrote in part, quote, "The most essential journalism of every era is precisely that which a government attempts to silence." These prosecutions demonstrate that they are ready to stop the presses, if they can. Snowden is among many who have spoken out since Greenwald was charged with cybercrime on January 21st. Members of the press and human rights advocates have called his prosecution an attempt to intimidate and retaliate against him and The Intercept for critical reporting about officials in Brazilian President Bolsonaro's government. Both Snowden and Greenwald serve on the board of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Listeners will recall that Greenwald is one of the journalists to whom Snowden leaked classified materials in 2013. Snowden, who's lived with asylum protection in Russia since that year, noted that although even some of Greenwald's critics have recently supported him, Julian has not experienced such solidarity. The Courage Foundation, however, is advocating on his behalf and running his legal defense fund as he languishes in a London prison under conditions that have raised global alarm while he fights against extradition to the United States. Joining us with an update on Julian Assange's situation is New York attorney Deb Herbeck and Nathan Fuller, executive director of the Courage Foundation. Deb and Nathan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
Thanks for having us.
Brazilian prosecutors are essentially using the same theory against Glenn Greenwald as Trump's prosecutors used against Julian, that journalists who published leaked documents are engaging in a criminal conspiracy with the sources who provided those documents. Nathan, what are your thoughts on that?
I think this is a new disturbing trend in what's been an ongoing war on journalism. It's an escalation of the Obama administration's war on whistleblowers, and they're taking it now to the publishers. To do that and to mask the extremely grave threat it poses to the First Amendment, they're trying to imply that these journalists are doing more than simply publishing, that they're engaging in new tactics to communicate with their sources, and that those tactics somehow change the nature of journalism. And so they're kind of wanting to set a precedent here that is very threatening to the First Amendment that can then be used much more broadly in the future against other publishers. And they can use it however they like against publishing that they don't like.
Deb, let's talk about the Espionage Act. It's an old act. When has it been used? And if it has, how often?
Well, the Espionage Act dates back to 1917. It was enacted during wartime, in fact, right after the First World War began. The goal of the act was to criminalize spies and saboteurs who were seeking to undermine U.S. military interests. It was never intended to be used against the press or against journalists. In fact, as a matter of legislative history, the a press freedom exception was actually in the initial act. So it hasn't been, it's never been used to prosecute a journalist or a publication.
In Julian's case, the charges came years after the Obama Justice Department considered and rejected them. What's the difference now? Deb, Nathan, what do you think about that?
So the biggest difference now is that Trump's in office. And the problem is that the Obama administration had a grand jury into WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, and they were investigating them right basically since the publications in 2010 began. And they kept that grand jury open, that investigation open throughout his presidency. So the Obama administration and Eric Holder had a discussion, decided that they could go after the source but not the publisher, and they decided that, that they couldn't because of what they called the New York Times problem, the First Amendment problem being that, like, if we're going to prosecute WikiLeaks, why there's no reason why we can't just prosecute the New York Times for the same thing, for publishing the same documents. And so they decided that was a step too far. But the Obama administration, make no mistake, was not pro-WikiLeaks or anything, pro-publishing. They kept that grand jury investigation open. They prosecuted the source in an unprecedented prosecution of military whistleblower Chelsea Manning, which equated her whistleblowing with espionage and with treason. And then they left that investigation open into WikiLeaks, kind of setting the table here for a more aggressive Trump administration to take it to the next step. And so it's an escalation, but both administrations have helped each other basically in the war on whistleblowing and the war on journalism here.
Interestingly, though, President Obama did commute Chelsea Manning's sentence so that she only served about 7 years. Julian Assange is facing in excess of 175 years if he's convicted.
And moreover, once Chelsea got out, they put her back in because she wouldn't cooperate with the government in trying to go after Julian Assange. What are your thoughts on that?
Right. That's the grand jury investigation into WikiLeaks that's been going on for a decade now. And so grand jury investigations are supposed to only run for 18 months, but they can just be renewed right after they expire. So this grand jury investigation has subpoenaed Chelsea Manning and actually also Jeremy Hammond, the Stratfor leak source. And they're both wanted to testify against Julian Assange, but it's a very secret process. And there's no accountability or transparency, and that's why both Hammond and Manning are refusing to testify on principle.
Well, when Chelsea refused to testify on principle, they put her back in prison. And when she continued to refuse to testify, they fined her $1,000 a day. The law, as I understand it, is that if it's clear that a person is not going to testify, they can no longer be coerced by imprisoned, and they have to let them out. But they haven't let her out yet, have they?
No, there's definitely precedent for some anarchists who have decided that they are not going to testify, and the judge realizes that no amount of prison time is going to change their minds and realizes that further imprisonment is punitive. And that's exactly what's happening here, and the judge is just not allowing that. But I think the fact that they're not having any, showing any leniency to Manning or Hammond shows exactly how aggressively they're going after Assange, because they really want more information and more details to bring something new against Assange. One problem with the prosecution against Assange and WikiLeaks for the U.S. is that this is a 10-year-old crime now with no real new evidence. And that's why it's so obviously a political persecution and prosecution. It's just deciding to prosecute something where no new evidence or testimony has come forward. But they're just, it's a new decision to prosecute the old act. So they're trying to get anything new they can get from Hammond and Manning and make their case a little stronger.
And Michael, you make a very good point. The purpose of punishing people for contempt of court is coercive, not punitive under the law. And so when it's determined that it's no longer, that the punishment is no longer of coercive impact, she absolutely should be released under the law because it's purely punitive to keep her in at this point.
It's been noted that Julian has not received the kind of support that even we're seeing with Glenn Greenwald, whose critics are actually coming to his support. I'd like to talk a bit about the Courage Foundation for supporting Julian. Why do you think Julian is perhaps a polarizing figure? And can you tell us a bit about what the Courage Foundation does? Because you support some of Law and Disorder's biggest heroes.
Sure. Yeah, maybe I should quickly do a little background on Courage. So I covered the Chelsea Manning trial in 2011 to 2013 for Chelsea Manning Support Network. And that was right around when that trial ended, was when Edward Snowden was getting to Moscow in exile. And we really realized that these whistleblowers are not being served well by their supporters, that we need to be a little bit more prepared to help out the next Ed Snowden, the next Chelsea Manning, the next Jeremy Hammond. And so we decided to create an international support network for whistleblowers, but also other journalistic sources. There are some hackers who are not government insiders, but who nevertheless take risks to expose the classified documents of the most powerful. And so we decided that we want to support everyone on the journalistic information chain, from whistleblower to editor to publisher. And so we've been raising funds and awareness about the cases of Manning and Hammond, Lori Love and others. And it only made sense then when, especially in May of or April 2017, when CIA Director Mike Pompeo kind of went on a very brazen, aggressive attack on WikiLeaks, making a speech calling them a hostile non-state intelligence agency. And that was really declaring war on WikiLeaks and really on the First Amendment, as we had long expected and feared might happen. And so since then, we've really ramped up our support and made WikiLeaks a beneficiary, and have since then been raising funds for WikiLeaks and Assange's legal defense and public campaigning, and have tried to explain just how grave this threat is.
Ed Snowden, in his recent op-ed, noted that the Trump administration, quote, with its disdain for press freedom, matched only by its ignorance of the law, has respected no such limitations on its ability to prosecute and persecute, and its unprecedented decision to indict a publisher under the Espionage Act has profoundly dangerous implications for national security journalists around the country. Now, do you think, both of you, that we are starting down a slippery slope where not just journalists with publications, but also authors who might write about national security may be prosecuted?
Absolutely. What's going on now is the government is weaponizing the Espionage Act to crush investigative journalism. And it's Trump has made no secret of his distaste for any journalists who criticize. And this is, of course, typical of authoritarian governments across the world. And his mimics, such as Bolsonaro in Brazil and the Saudi Arabian government and their treatment of Khashoggi, are basically understanding now that they can act with impunity when they go after journalists and the press for criticizing them or exposing their misdeeds, in the safety of knowing that the U.S. government is no longer going to exert the sort of international pressure of spreading what used to be our democratic vision of freedom of the press and freedom of speech throughout the world. Authors are absolutely in danger. Anyone who writes anything that can be called a breach of an official secret, even if they were never legally bound to keep such secrets, are now at risk.
I've had some negative experience with liberal friends of mine whom I ask for support of Julian Assange, and their answer is, well, I support him in principle, but I really don't like him, and I'm not going to do much about it. Why are people not speaking up in support of Julian?
So that kind of argument is what the government relies on. They rely on dividing popular opinion by first spending years to smear the character of a person like Julian, a dissident like Julian and his colleagues, and to wearing down public opinion. I mean, initially, I believe Assange was voted Time Person of the Year in 2011, maybe, and he's been nominated for Nobel Peace Prizes. He's been given all kinds of journalism awards over the last decade, including the Walkley Award, which is the Australian equivalent of the Pulitzer. He's been incredibly respected, but at the same time, the government and mainstream media have really worked together here to smear the character of Assange. The Swedish investigation has been incredibly useful in smearing him and distracting people from the main threat here. And so once then popular opinion had sufficiently eroded, then they're ready to go on attack. And so we get Assange arrested when his popularity is at its lowest point after the Trump-Russia situation of 2016 through 18. Yeah, it's been it's difficult to counter that when there are so many smears, but that's why it's so important to counter each one and to really investigate where they come from and what their use is.
And progressives need to be very careful not to fall into the trap of permitting the government to basically use the unpopularity of what's now a pariah, like an individual of Julian Assange that they've made him into through their character assassination, to undermine our fundamental constitutional freedoms.
Former New York Times reporter James Risen, who himself was targeted by the government with a series of subpoenas several years ago, he is now with The Intercept, and he just published an op-ed in The Times likening the cases of Greenwald and Assange. He wrote that, quote, the State Department has not issued any statement of concern about Brazil's case against Mr. Greenwald, which in past administrations would have been a common practice. Do you think, both of you, that we're seeing a trend where other nations are becoming emboldened to bring such charges after Julian's indictment?
Absolutely. And in that same piece, Risen notes that he spoke with Greenwald, and Greenwald himself said that he doesn't believe the Bolsonaro government would have felt comfortable and confident enough going this aggressively against him without the support of the Trump administration. And that's how it works, really. The U.S. dictates what's published not only in and beyond its borders about it, but with the power it wields, it can dictate what other countries allow. And so this is absolutely an international effort to an international war on journalism. And the fact that Greenwald has been prosecuted with these incredibly trumped up and dangerous charges is just another worrying step in this ongoing escalation.
I do think it's important to remember that even with Khashoggi and the Trump administration's lack of condemnation of the absolutely despicable treatment of a journalist who criticized the Saudi government, that emboldened authoritarians worldwide to not worry about the U.S. coming after them.
We're speaking with Deborah Beck, New York City attorney active in Julian Assange defense, and Nathan Fuller, who is the head of the Courage Foundation here in New York City, about the situation with Julian Assange.
Now, I understand Julian is finally out of solitary confinement. How is his health now?
He's in very bad shape, primarily mentally. He's in solitary confinement, even though he's out of the health area of the prison. And he's someone that needs interaction, and he's profoundly depressed. Friends who've visited him and observers who've seen him in his court appearances have evinced enormous concern over his well-being. His father is convinced that he's going to die in prison if he doesn't get out soon.
We should remember that while he's been imprisoned in Belmarsh since April 2019, he's really been held in detention since 2012. And so he's been, more than 7-8 years now, he's been held in incredibly small spaces with very limited mobility, access to health care, access to the outside world, really. So this is really just an intensified version of what he's endured over the last nearly a decade. And so it's absolutely essential that he gets some medical care very soon. More than 60 doctors have written an open letter to the prison and to the UK asking that he be transferred to a university hospital to get real health care. And so we should think about the U.S. healthcare system when we think about in prisons, when we think about what could happen to Julian if he were sent here. The Courage Foundation spent a lot of time leading the defense campaign for Lowry Love, a UK alleged hacker who is facing extradition to the United States over charges that his alleged cohorts got mere months in prison in the UK, but he was threatened with decades in prison here in the US. And a key argument against extradition, and he did defeat extradition, was the incredibly poor healthcare in the United States prison system, that he has depression and would not get the kind of medical treatment that he really needed. And so I think looking at what's happening in the UK and what's even worse that he could face in the US, it's a really dire situation. And so preventing his extradition is just incredibly important for his well-being, not only for our First Amendment well-being.
And when should we expect to hear a decision on the extradition issue?
Well, there's the initial extradition hearing starts in London on February 24th. That hearing is scheduled to run for 5 weeks, but it's broken up. So the initial hearing won't end until, I think, the end of March, if everything goes to schedule. But, of course, whatever way the decision goes, the losing side will inevitably appeal. So we have a long ways to wait until we see whether Julian is ultimately extradited to the United States. And we are beginning to really try to raise awareness amongst people in the United States about how important this is to start garnering support and countering the character assassination that's been going on that's helped to suppress support in the United States. We have an event coming up on February 15th in New York, and it's entitled
The Prosecution of Julian Assange, His Right to Publish is Our Right to Know. And that's reminding that while he needs the right to publish information under the First Amendment, what we're really concerned about here, or an element that we're concerned about here, is the public's right to have an access at the table. These are documents that are incredibly overclassified, kept secret without our input or knowledge, and the public deserves a seat at that table. And that's what whistleblowers and investigative journalists try to bring us. And so that's going to be February 15th at CUNY Law School. In Queens, go to defend.wikileaks.org/events for more information about that and other events coming up.
Yeah, that's at 2 o'clock at CUNY Law School in Queens.
And for those listeners that are outside of New York, we had a fabulous event last Thursday at the National Press Club in D.C. And coming up on February 9th in L.A., we have another Assange event. So this is a national campaign to start to raise awareness about the importance to press freedoms of defending Assange.
Deb and Nathan, I wanted to ask you about the defenses to extradition that Julian can raise. I understand that if a person is being extradited and the situation is that the person has done a political crime, the laws of England prevent the extradition. And moreover, I understand that under European law, not American law, because Julian was spied upon, you know, the CIA had direct TV cameras linking the Ecuadorian embassy in London to Langley, Virginia, the CIA headquarters, so they could spy on him, they could watch him, they could listen to him, they could learn what his attorneys were telling him, they could even spy on him in the toilet. And that kind of intrusion on the attorney-client privilege is something that under European law, I think, would bar an extradition. What's your opinion on that?
Michael, I'm so glad you raised the issue of the surveillance in the embassy. It's really been shocking, the lack of attention that this has received in the United States. El País, a Spanish publication, released this really amazing scoop last year, disclosing the fact that UC Global, a Spanish security company that had been engaged by the Ecuadorian government to provide security in the Ecuadorian embassy, allegedly was working with the CIA to transfer information that they received from collecting information within the embassy, supposedly for security reasons, directly to the CIA. This has been disclosed from discovery in a Spanish case that was brought by one of Julian Assange's lawyers in Spain. The Spanish courts are taking this very seriously. The American government and public, despite a couple news reports, there was a report in the New York Times relating this, seem remarkably uninterested. There were U.S. lawyers and journalists who visited Julian. I personally visited him many times in the embassy. We had our phones taken away from us, our computers taken away from us. We thought just for security, and we've now learned that they were opening up the phones, taking information from them. It's really horrific what went on, and that the U.S. government appears to have been encouraging it, and receiving the information only bolsters the defense that to the extradition that this is actually a political prosecution.
James Goodale, the former New York Times general counsel who defended that paper's right to publish the Pentagon Papers, has written an op-ed recently comparing that spying on Assange to what happened to Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg's therapist's office was broken into, and that illegal surveillance was the reason that his case was dropped. The Nixon administration had obviously overstepped its bounds, and they couldn't bring that case fully to trial. And Goodale compared that case to Assange's spying, and that's definitely going to be a big argument in the defense's case in this extradition hearing. The other one you mentioned is this exception in the U.S.-UK extradition treaty of 2003, which has generally allowed fairly free flow of extradition requests from the U.K. to the U.S. primarily. Does have this exemption where you cannot extradite for a political offense. And so that's definitely going to be a key argument of this Assange's legal defense, that this is a clearly political prosecution. They're going after him for embarrassing public officials and exposing their secret documents. And they're doing something with no new evidence or anything from the Obama administration, which declined to prosecute. So it's an overtly political prosecution, and I hope really that that's going to be stopped on that basis.
Deb and Nathan, we're running out of time, but let's remind listeners where to go to A, learn more about this case, and B, to get involved, because we need that right now.
Sure. So, yeah, Courage hosts defend.wikileaks.org, where you can find a live blog and ongoing developments in Assange's case and information about how to get involved in your area. And defend.wikileaks.org/events has more information about this New York event and the one in Los Angeles. And just to remind people, New York City, February 15th at CUNY School of Law at 2 p.m., we have a big event for the prosecution of Julian Assange, and that will feature James Goodale, that former New York Times general counsel, among others.
And his right to publish is our right to know. It's very important that people educate themselves and learn more about the topic and stay open-minded.
And well there's said. That terrific book, In Defense of Julian Assange, that you can get from OAR Books. And I recommend that to everybody. We've talked about that book on our program. Nathan, Deb, thank you so much for coming into the studio and being our guests on Law and Disorder.
Thank you both.
Thank you. Appreciate
Take
it.
Take care. Good luck. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Democrats appear to have failed in their effort to remove President Donald Trump from office. The Republicans hold a 53-47 majority in the Senate, which is trying Trump. A joke going around is that even if Trump shot a senator on the Senate floor, he would still win acquittal by a vote of 53-47, unless he shot a Republican. Then the vote would be 52-47. Trump was charged with withholding congressionally approved military aid to the Ukraine and trying to enlist help from the president of the Ukraine if he, the Ukrainian president, announced a corruption investigation of Joe Biden. Secondly, Trump is charged with obstruction of justice because of Trump's not cooperating with the Democratic Party investigation. The Democrats went after Trump on the narrowest of grounds. Trump's corruption and war crimes were ignored. Trump's lawyers defended him on the grounds that even if true, he did nothing wrong. Then they asserted that a sitting president can block witnesses at his own impeachment trial, an authoritarian notion that destroys the checks and balances system of our Constitution. The failure of the Democrats to impeach Trump will certainly benefit Trump in the upcoming election. We welcome back award-winning journalist Aaron Maté to talk more about the impeachment trial. Maté writes for The Nation magazine and has the podcast Pushback on the Gray Zone.
Aaron, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me back.
Aaron, why did the Democrats narrow the charges by only accusing Trump of jeopardizing national security by withholding military aid to the Ukraine in its proxy war with neighboring Russia? And secondly, with obstruction of justice for not cooperating with the investigation?
Well, they focused group some of the charges. They tried bribery and extortion, but apparently it didn't really land with people. And they faced a problem here in that they couldn't really find a material crime. And so they went with abuse of power, which is ambiguous and deliberately so, because, you know, as I argued from the start, I think the case that they had was actually pretty weak. Their theory might have been true that Trump leveraged military funding to Ukraine to compel some investigations, but I don't think they ever actually proved it with the witnesses that they called. So I think they needed something more ambiguous to overcome that hurdle. And then adding on the second charge of obstructing Congress was another sort of easy but also relatively weak charge to go with, because I just don't think they had very much here.
In retrospect, what could Trump have been charged with? If you were drawing up the articles of impeachment, what would you have included?
Well, if it were up to me, I wouldn't have gone for impeachment on this Ukraine issue at all. I would have gone with killing people overseas with bombs and sanctions. You know, the assassination of Qasem Soleimani to me was a war crime, imposing murderous sanctions on Iran and Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua and Syria, cutting off millions in aid to Central American migrants to extort Honduras and Guatemala and other countries to prevent migrants from coming to the U.S., cutting off hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to Palestinians to blackmail them into giving up their rights under international law, imposing the Muslim ban. All these things to me are impeachable. But the problem with Democrats is that they don't have the political courage to take those issues on, or they're in fact complicit in those crimes. So they instead choose to go with something like Ukraine Gate, which to me is just, A, it's their allegation that Trump leveraged this military funding is not even proven, and B, even if it's true, to me it's very minor on the scale of Trump's actual crimes. And the reason why I think it's such a priority for Democrats is in part because they've latched on to a very hawkish Cold War mentality as their way to challenge Donald Trump since his election. And the fact that he briefly paused some military funding for Ukraine is, in that context, seen as egregious, when in fact, I think it's actually a good thing to pause military funding to Ukraine, because doing so would put the U.S. back in line with the policy of Barack Obama, where Barack Obama refused to send that same military funding at all because he didn't want to further inflame a proxy war that he started in Ukraine when his administration overthrew a government in Ukraine, and that set off fighting in the Donbass, which is where this military funding was going. And Obama was concerned about making that fighting worse. He also was concerned about U.S. weapons falling into the hands of neo-Nazis, which is a very real component inside the Ukrainian armed forces that we're supporting. And so I think Obama's policy was right in that respect, and that's why I think it's strange to try to impeach Trump for briefly not following it.
What role did the intelligence community play in the impeachment?
Well, as my friend and colleague Max Blumenthal says, the intelligence community is neither a community nor is it intelligent. And in this case, they played a critical role. The so-called whistleblower comes from the CIA, and they appeared very alarmed when Trump ordered this brief pause on the military funding to Ukraine. And It was this whistleblower who collected the concerns of other people inside the intelligence and national security community. And they were outraged at the thought that this money to buy U.S. weapons was put on hold. And in fact, you know, there was even alarm voice from inside the Pentagon when military defense contractors and their representatives were calling the Pentagon to complain that this military funding was put on hold, which just speaks to the interest at play here. This is not about national security. The idea that, you know, as Adam Schiff said, we're fighting Russia over there so that we don't have to fight them here. He actually said that in his impeachment trial speech. I mean, it's a joke. It's a complete joke. And the actual interest here are those who profit from continued war and tensions with Russia. And they played an absolutely critical role in this impeachment scandal, as they did during Russiagate. And that's why, it's been alarming to see Democrats and even some progressives getting enlisted in their Cold War designs.
Let's talk about Senator Adam Schiff. He's a liberal hero in the impeachment effort. Writing in Jacobin magazine, Lisa Featherstone observed that Schiff is, quote, a wholly owned subsidiary of the military-industrial complex and a fervent exponent of permanent war, end quote. She calls him a dangerous warmonger and accuses him of paranoia with respect to Russia, which she says serves to feed his agenda. The Democrats treat Russia as a great enemy, and this has dangerous implications, doesn't it?
It does. His rhetoric has been unhinged. And I think anybody who wants to defeat Trump in 2020, and also anybody who wants to stop militarism in this country, should not be welcoming Adam Schiff, as has been happening in some circles, but be opposing it. His rhetoric is dangerous and unhinged. So he said that we are fighting Russia over there so that we don't have to fight them here. He said that Trump briefly pausing this military funding was undermining our national security. I mean, these things are jokes, and they're dangerous because the underlying presumption here is that somehow fighting a proxy war with nuclear-armed Russia is good for national security, when in fact it endangers not just U.S. national security but global security, because tensions between these two nuclear-armed powers are existential for the entire world. And the craziest part is that it comes at a time when Trump, in reality, contrary to the deluded fantasies of Adam Schiff, Trump himself has been more confrontational towards Russia than Obama was, and increased tensions. So the opposition party, instead of encouraging Trump to engage with Russia in negotiations, is in fact egging him on and encouraging him effectively by calling him weak on Russia to be even more hawkish. Because what is happening in reality? Well, Trump right now, he has torn up the INF treaty, a critical Cold War nuclear pact that limited the deployment of nuclear weapons. He's now threatening the New START treaty, which is the last remaining pact that limits nuclear weapons arsenals. And where are Democrats on this? Why aren't they calling on Trump to immediately renew New START and to immediately recommit to the INF treaty that Trump tore up? Instead, they're accusing him of being soft on Russia. So it's insanity. On top of all the other places where Trump has been confrontational, he's trying to stop the construction of a critical Russia-Germany gas pipeline and has threatened sanctions to do that. He is trying to overthrow Russia's key ally in Latin America, in Venezuela, and Russia and the U.S. are clashing over that. He's ramping up tensions with Iran over the objections of Russia. So there's all these areas where Democrats should, in fact, be pushing back on Trump's dangerous policy with Russia. But instead, what are they doing? Because he briefly paused some military funding, they're accusing him of being soft on Russia and doing its bidding. So Adam Schiff is incredibly dangerous for the progressive cause and for the future of the world. And it is crazy to see him being welcomed as a hero. The only person he's a hero for is, as you mentioned, weapons contractors, who understandably have been major donors to his campaign.
Ajamu Baraka, organizer of Black Alliance for Peace and the Green Party's vice presidential candidate in the last election, observed about the impeachment that, quote, right-wing Democrats are the war party. Let there be no confusion about this. They are criticizing Trump from the right. Aaron, do you see it that way?
I 100% agree with that. It is, if you look at what the Democratic impeachment managers have been saying, all of them, they all come from a very right-wing place. They accept the presumption that we should be fighting a proxy war with Russia and Ukraine, and they repeatedly sound like Republicans. I mean, it was George W. Bush who talked about we have to fight them over there so that we don't have to fight them here. That's what he said throughout his fake war on terror, as he was also selling the war in Iraq. And now Democrats are co-opting that language and applying it to their impeachment. So Democrats are deploying right-wing rhetoric to try to take down a far-right president. It really is insane. And think of all the things that it is distracting our attention from. There's been this myth that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. The Democrats can pursue Russiagate and now pursue Ukrainegate, but also pursue a progressive policy agenda. Well, where is that? I mean, all this does is push serious issues like health care and wage inequality and job security and Social Security and Medicare and all these things that Trump is attacking. All it does, and food stamps. I mean, just now Trump is throwing off hundreds of thousands of people off of food stamps. Well, where is that from the national discussion? It's all completely sidelined in favor of a right-wing agenda that is trying to challenge Trump for briefly not arming Ukraine to fight a stupid proxy war with Russia. It really is a right-wing impeachment, and it's, you know, progressives should try to reckon with that.
Now, Trump was not alone in meddling in the Ukraine. Can you talk about the Democrats, Obama, Biden, and Clinton, and their role in the 2014 overthrow of the democratically elected government of Ukraine? Why did they do that? And what was their long-term goal? And what's the long-term goal of the Democrats now?
There has been a long-standing effort inside Washington, D.C., and it's been bipartisan, to entrench the power of NATO and to encroach on Russia and basically bring the countries surrounding Russia into the Western orbit. I mean, the basis for this is the fact that the collapse of the Soviet Union was predicated on an agreement between the U.S. and Russia that the U.S. would not expand NATO one inch to the east. That was the promise made by the George H.W. Bush administration to Gorbachev. Well, in reality, the exact opposite happened. And starting with the first Bush and continuing under Clinton and continuing through George W. Bush and Barack Obama and Trump, NATO has continued to expand up to Russia's borders. And Ukraine has been seen as a prize in that and as a goal in that. And what happened in Ukraine is that basically you had the U.S. spending literally billions of dollars to foment unrest inside Ukraine, it culminating in the overthrow of, as you say, the President Yanukovych, who was corrupt, and there were protests against Yanukovych. But basically the U.S. and its allies exploited those protests and egged them on to generate Yanukovych's overthrow. And Yanukovych was described as being pro-Russian, but really he was someone who actually wanted to keep Ukraine neutral. He wanted to have economic agreements with both the European Union and Russia. But that was undermined by this Maidan coup that the U.S. played a critical role in generating. So he is overthrown. The U.S. installs a more friendly government. And then you have a war breaking out in the Donbas region in the east of Ukraine between the new Ukrainian coup government and Ukrainians who identify with Russia, because Ukraine is a mixed country. There are people who strongly identify with the West. There are people who strongly identify with Russia. So the obvious answer for everybody is just to keep Ukraine neutral. But it's been the imperial mindset in Washington that's not good enough. We need to bring Ukraine into our orbit, and that's what now explains this ongoing proxy war where thousands of people have died. And, you know, the military funding that Trump briefly paused is an element of that. So that's what this is about. Adam Schiff says this is about stopping Russian expansionism and Russian aggression in Europe. It's the exact opposite. It's actually about supporting U.S. and NATO expansion in Europe, and Russia is in the way of that, so hence this proxy war.
We've been speaking with Aaron Mate, an award-winning journalist, puts out Pushback on the Gray Zone. Aaron, let's talk about the role of the media in all of this. Let's take a step backwards and appreciate the role of the media in the last scandal, Russiagate. Putin was said to be a Trump asset and colluded with him. And Greenwald observed that Russiagate came to a pitiful anticlimactic end. Was Russiagate a hoax?
It was a hoax. It was a total scam. It was this fantasy that Donald J. Trump conspired with the Kremlin, along with his associates, and somehow that could explain his improbable victory. In reality, what happened was that Trump managed to convince enough voters in the swing states, because we have an unfair electoral college system, that he was going to defend the working class. And enough people got convinced by it and voted for him as a protest against what they saw as a corrupt establishment. Now, of course, we know that Trump's promises of being of draining the swamp and all that, we know that that was a con. The problem is Democrats, instead of doing honest self-reflection and trying to learn some lessons from their defeat, responded with a con of their own. And they were joined by the national security state in that to basically put forward this idea that the reason Trump won was that he was engaged in a secret conspiracy with Russia, and that Russia, because it was accused of stealing Democratic Party emails, that somehow Russia was responsible for Trump's victory. And those two interests of, you know, failed Democratic elites plus a national security state that didn't like Trump for their own reasons, not because they don't like his racism or his misogyny, but because they didn't see him as a suitable steward of the U.S. war machine, those basically aligned to concoct this fake idea that Trump conspired with Russia. And they fueled it with a series of selective leaks and straight-up falsehoods and frauds, including what they perpetrated on the FISA court, as we know now, by relying on things like the Steele dossier, which was a DNC-funded work of fiction that alleged a high-level blackmail and conspiracy scheme between Trump and Russia. So, yeah, the whole thing was a joke. The evidence for it was never there. A few of us, like Glenn and myself, pointed this out from the start, that it was not just baseless, but was ultimately going to hand Trump a very big gift when it inevitably collapsed. And after 3 years, that's exactly what happened. And now we're living through its sequel, Ukraine Gate.
Aaron, how is the media behaving during this current impeachment saga? Can you specifically talk about MSNBC and CNN?
Well, the problem with the media is that for their own branding purposes and because of their own political alignments, they align themselves pretty much with the establishment of the Democratic Party, which means that they portray themselves as being anti-Trump, but they do so on incredibly narrow grounds. They basically, you know, they oppose him based on Russiagate, where they accuse them of being soft on Russia and possibly being complicit with it in a conspiracy, which turned out to be fake. And now they're going along again with Ukrainegate, because, again, this is another so-called scandal that results from an alignment between the Democratic Party establishment and the national security state. So they're doing that here again. They pose as being anti-Trump, and so they're very invested in promoting whatever the national security state and the Democratic Party deem to be anti-Trump. But it means in the process that they do so, again, dishonestly. They ignore the countervailing facts, and they hype it up as if being something existential. So they're always talking about how this is could be the end of President Trump and the walls are closing in. Well, they did that for 3 years during Russiagate, and we know the result. And so we're seeing something similar here where, again, they give their viewers the impression that this is going to bring down Trump, and that what he is, and they go along with this notion that he has endangered the country because he paused some military aid, while again ignoring the actual facts of the case, and I think more importantly, ignoring real issues that impact people. And so again, we have a media system that is completely divorced, not just from reality and from facts, which is supposed to be the job of journalists, but also from real issues. So we're not seeing on CNN or MSNBC discussions about healthcare or jobs or Social Security. We're seeing, again, the focus of our media being this very narrow intra-elite fight focused on, you know, the hawkish national security state issues.
15 former intelligence officials are now commentators on CNN and MSNBC. The influence of the intelligence community, especially the CIA, on the media was once a secret, but now it's out in the open. Some have charged MSNBC and CNN as being a, quote, state news service. What do you think?
Oh, it's unbelievable, the preponderance of former intelligence officials on MSNBC and CNN, which literally means that these networks, as they cover the top stories of the last 3 years, Russiagate and then Ukrainegate, when they cover them, they're literally covering their colleagues. You know, John Brennan, the former head of the CIA, he's at MSNBC. Andrew Weissman, the top leader of the Mueller probe, he's at MSNBC. James Clapper, former director of the Office of National Intelligence, he's at CNN. along with Andrew McCabe, top FBI official, played a key role in the Mueller probe. It's just a joke. And, you know, it doesn't just mean that these networks are biased when they cover Russiagate and Ukrainegate. It also means that, you know, when they cover so-called national security issues, that their coverage is totally impacted by the biases of the national security state. So it's state TV on steroids, and it's incredibly dangerous, and it means that people will not get an objective look at these critical issues at all, not just of Russiagate and Ukrainegate, but, you know, if the U.S. goes and bombs Iraq and kills Qasem Soleimani, you're getting the views of people who have worked in the national security state bureaucracy their whole lives, which means that they're not critical, that they're actually partisans of the national security state. So you're not going to have the kind of criticism that a real free media would have.
Trump won't release documents to the Senate trial and said, quote, I have it. They don't. He asserts executive privilege to try to bar people in his administration from testifying. Can a sitting president block witnesses at his own impeachment trial? And if so, what does this mean for the growth of an authoritarian state?
Well, you know, I think that's a fair concern, and I do wish there could be witnesses and documents released. The problem, though, here is that I do think Democrats gave Trump this opportunity because, again, they controlled the impeachment proceedings when this was in the House before they sent the articles over. And at that point, they could have subpoenaed anything they wanted. They could have subpoenaed Bolton. They could have subpoenaed all these documents. And when Trump said no, instead of deferring and sending over their articles to the Senate anyway, they could have fought it in court. And that would have been the place to do it. And they chose not to. That was their own choice. And, you know, I think now the problem is Trump's defense attorneys are saying, well, look, they chose not to do this, so why do we have to do their work for them? So they're basically saying, you know, from the Trump defense team's point of view, Democrats have not proved their case, and they didn't go the route of subpoenaing documents. So Trump's attorneys are saying, well, you know, we're not going to do your work for you. And so whether or not that's constitutional and legal, I think that's up to the courts to decide. I think it's unfortunate. I wish Trump's team could just comply. But at the same time, I understand their strategy here, which is saying that if they're not compelled to, and if Democrats made the choice not to pursue this in court, that they're not going to take the time to hand Democrats what they're not compelled to do.
Aaron Maté, after the Biden-supported 2014 coup in the Ukraine, his son Hunter got a job for $50,000 a month for a major Ukrainian national gas company. And this is all very fishy, but it's not been gone into at all, has it? Biden has said he didn't even talk to his son about it.
Biden has said that, but yet Hunter Biden, the son, said in a New York Profile that they did have at least one conversation about it. So even there, Joe Biden's claim is it should be called into question. Look, this is the problem. You know, even if it turns out that Joe Biden really was acting with pure intent when he got the prosecutor who was investigating Burisma, Hunter Biden's company, fired, the fact is, even if that were true, the fact is it's transparently corrupt that the unqualified son of a vice president whose government, by the way, had just overthrown the government of Ukraine and installed a new one. It's transparently corrupt that Hunter Biden got this gig. He paid up to $83,000 per month. He doesn't speak Ukrainian, has no expertise in the industry. So it's transparently corrupt. And by the way, this is happening as Joe Biden was supposedly the point man for fighting corruption in Ukraine. So it's transparently sketchy, and this has been part of my problem with this impeachment thing from the beginning, is that just like Russiagate, focusing on it by Democrats would inevitably bring attention to their candidate's own corruption, which I always thought was a gift to Trump. So the heart of Russiagate were these stolen emails that showed corruption by Hillary Clinton and her allies in the DNC. And that's what Democrats chose to focus on for 3 years. And now it's the same thing. Democrats have embraced a scandal that inevitably brings focus on the fact that one of their leading candidates, Joe Biden, had a son who got a lucrative position, solely because he was Joe Biden's son. I mean, it's transparently corrupt. The Democrats chose to bring attention to this. And why? Because they're more focused on basically defending their corrupt candidates than they are in fighting Trump's corruption and in fighting for real issues. I mean, Democrats focusing incredibly on these basically intra-elite squabbles. They're more aggrieved by Trump going after one of their own, even if they're corrupt, than they are Trump going after food stamp recipients or people in Iran and Venezuela and working people across this country. So it cements this idea of Democrats as being corrupt, out-of-touch elites, as both Russiagate and Ukrainegate illustrate. So it's as a partisan strategy, it just makes no sense, and it speaks to how attached Democrats are to serving the Democratic establishment instead of serving the American people.
Aaron Mate, it's been a pleasure for Heidi and me to be able to talk to you. Let me ask you for your final thoughts on this impeachment and then ask you how people can follow your work.
Final thoughts on the impeachment are that I hope it gets done with as soon as possible so that we can go back to focusing on other issues. This impeachment will not bring down Trump. And the more it goes on, it will just overshadow what I think is the only chance we have to beat Trump, which is the candidacy of Bernie Sanders on the primary. It is, to me, such a tragedy that instead of campaigning in Iowa and New Hampshire and bringing his message of social justice to the people, that Bernie Sanders has to sit in the Capitol and listen to Adam Schiff spew his unhinged Cold War delusions about how we have to fight Russia over there so we're not fighting them over here. The fact that Bernie Sanders has to sit through that and not be out there campaigning and talking to people about how he's going to bring them health care and improve their lives is, to me, just one aspect of this tragedy. So my hope is that Ukrainegate and the impeachment gets done with as soon as possible, and that Bernie Sanders can get back out to the campaign trail, and that all of us can focus our attention on supporting and electing him. Because to me, as Trump recently recognized in these leaked recordings that came out through Lev Parnas, Trump's even said privately that his biggest fear was that Hillary Clinton was going to pick Bernie Sanders as her VP because he felt as if Bernie Sanders could actually defeat him, and that he pointed out that some Sanders supporters voted for him because a lot of Sanders supporters were really against these so-called free trade agreements, and Trump posed as being against them as well. So Trump even recognized that Bernie Sanders can hurt him, which underscores the need for Bernie Sanders to be supported, to be the nominee, and for this impeachment thing to be done with as soon as possible.
I just wanted to ask you one last thing. How can people follow your work?
I host a show for The Gray Zone, and they can catch it at thegrayzone.com. My show is called Pushback, and I also write for The Nation magazine, and I will have something up there very soon.
Great. This has been a very illustrative and educational interview, Aaron Mate. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me back.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.